The wildlife and its habitat cannot speak, so we must, and we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast. Here's Executive Director Brandon Butler.
It's opening night of Missouri's 2018 youth turkey season, and I'm sitting down with legendary hunter Ray I. Ray, we didn't put a bird on the ground this morning, but we've had a great weekend so far.
Been an awesome weekend, a great time. It was a good hunt today. A little cold out there for the kids, but woods is extremely open. But what a weekend. A great bunch of kids. We had the other night, we went in and shot the guns with the kids and orientation, I guess is what you call it, and talked about turkey hunting and had a lot of the folks from the Department of Conservation there. Of course, you were there and the Turkey Federation, and what a great bunch of kids. And that was all fun. But then we went to dinner with the governor, to the governor's mansion. How cool is that? That was a great experience for those kids. And then we got to spend time in the woods today. We stayed out there all day. We came in for a little bit, but went right back out and stayed. I shot some great video today. We didn't get to shoot a turkey. We were really close. But, you know, it's not always about shooting the turkey. But, you know, the kids and the time we had today out there, it was awesome.
Well, this privilege of my job is to be able to help host the governor's youth turkey hunt. This is the fifth year I've been able to do it. And it grows on me every year. You know, I think the nerves are starting to subside a little bit, and more excitement is taking the place of worrying about it going right. Because when you got kids involved, it's just really hard to screw it up.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it is.
They're just
is.
So excited to be out there and to have the instruction from the hunter education instructors. And then, like you said, to go to the governor's mansion and see
awesome. Their
eyes just turn into saucers when they walk through those doors and the history of the building. And then coming to understand that it's not just a historic building, it's also the home of our governor. And for him to come down and spend time with those kids, it's truly meaningful.
It's a great event.
Yeah, I never got to hang out with the governor when I was a kid.
No, I didn't either, but that was a great evening. One of the things I mentioned when we were at the dinner and I really enjoyed seeing was the number of girls we had this year. The girls that are hunting, the girls are outnumbering the boys. That's a neat thing.
Well, we had 20 youths and I didn't count, you know, but it was certainly more than 50% of them were girls.
Oh yeah, more than 50%.
Yeah, I have my own daughter, 12-year-old daughter, Bailey, with us on this hunt this year.
What a sweetheart.
She's,
I'm telling you.
Takes after her daddy.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. But boy, what a sweet kid. I just love that kid. She's awesome.
Yeah. We've had a hard hunt. We haven't seen a bird yet. So she's sticking in there, and we've got a plan for the morning. I think we're going to move to another stand and actually have a chance at seeing some gobblers.
We were so close this morning. We had two gobblers early come almost within gun range of our little shooter, and they went off into the woods. But anyway, we had a couple big gobblers strutting, following about a dozen hens, and they were following the girls. They didn't much care for me. They had the real thing in front of them, and they were out there 50, 60 yards, but they were going kind of angling away from us. We saw gobblers chasing gobblers. We had a good morning, and we almost got us a Jake with our young hunter, Zach, and it was just right there. Just didn't quite get the gun situation. You know, that happens.
Well, it was also the coldest turkey hunt I've ever been on my life.
Oh my gosh, was it cold this morning?
Well, it was 19 degrees when we left the cabin. I mean, that's not turkey hunting weather. We had to dig out our deer hunting clothes. I've got my child in Arctic boots.
Yeah.
And you're clogging around in the woods, and it's just not the same. You can't take off and run and gun when it's that cold. Everything's crispy, and every leaf sounds like you're stepping on potato chips.
And the woods are extremely open right now. It's wintertime woods. It's really hard to move around.
It just made for some hard hunting, but
it was still a quality time with the kids. I know our kids enjoyed it. We had snacks in the blind, you know, and talked and visited, and that's what I like about being inside of a blind. Your kids can get away with some movement and have some fun where you're not always hollering at them to sit still and don't move. You know, they had a good time.
My daughter, she killed a turkey when she was 7 years old. And looking back, I think maybe I rushed that a little bit. I might have pushed her a little bit too soon, maybe a little bit too hard. I know when she shot that bird, it was with a single shot 20 gauge that she had won at a NWTF banquet, but it hurt her shoulder. And I think she had some fear for a couple of years. So I paid for it for a couple of years, her not wanting to go. But now she's really getting back into it. So I've told myself that she's in charge. Whatever we do on this hunt, if she's bored and she wants to go, we're going to leave the blind. If she wants to sit there and rustle in a bag of potato chips, she can rustle in a bag of potato chips. Whatever I can do to keep her out in the woods with me, I want to make sure that she's having fun and that she's as comfortable as possible. And when she's bored and ready to go, we go. You know, I'm not hollering at her for being on her phone playing games during the downtime.
So you got to let the kids be kids. Let them have fun. If they don't have fun, they're not going to want to go back.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's just
I've
like
seen it too many times.
Going fishing. You know, you got to put them on some fish. Go bluegill fishing instead of musky fishing.
Right.
So,
well, you were talking about the gun hurting. One of the things I do, and I tell all the people that take these kids, don't shoot any turkey loads with these kids. One of the things I ran into is that that the adults, the dads, they mean well, but they want their child to shoot their gun, you know, and this is my turkey gun, you got to shoot my turkey. And it kicks a kid, and it does affect them. So I pattern all my guns with my kids. First of all, I put the 20-gauge in a lead sled where they don't have to hold a gun, and I never put a turkey load in a low brass, light loads for them to shoot at a target.
Right.
And they don't get a turkey load till we get in the woods.
And that adrenaline takes over.
Yeah, and then you're fine.
Yeah, we're actually at our good friend Rudy Raceline's property, and he's got his 8-year-old grandson out, and they're practicing with a 410 today.
That's so great.
Yeah, just seeing that kid feel comfortable with that firearm and having excitement to shoot it again and again and again, not having any fear of the recoil. I think it's really important to build that confidence in these young kids, and we've been seeing that all weekend.
Something I'd like to say, Brandon, while we're doing the show is, and I've said this before, and I've been a little outspoken with it, but it's great that we have a youth season, but like the weather we have today and other seasons, youth seasons we've had where we've had the bad weather and the open woods and gobblers are still running together, I'd love to see the kids get more time. The adults have hunted their entire life, and I'd rather see, even if they have to give them additional weekends like they do for the youth deer, but I'd like to see these kids get a week. And I've always said I'd like to see these kids in prime time, the best time possible to hunt turkeys, not in early April when the woods is terrible and it's cold like it was today. A lot of these seasons I've had with these kids, the weather was horrendous. If we could get these kids to hunt the weekend before the Missouri opener, and I've talked to I don't know how many turkey hunters, says, tell me about the weekend before Monday. They, oh my gosh, they were blowing it out. They were everywhere. Yeah. And I see that. And that also, the kids, if they can hunt that weekend, maybe a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they're already in the area for camp to go with grandpa and grandma and dad and already in turkey camp. But I'd rather see the kids have the prime time, the best time to go hunting, instead of early season. That's just well, the way I feel about it.
Isn't it just on us to make the choice to put them before us then?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to do that.
we just need to take the kids out. But we've killed enough birds, so
yeah.
Let's focus on the kids on prime time.
If they're going to have a good experience and a good turkey hunt and a good opportunity, I'd rather see them in more the prime time.
Right. What I mean by what I just said is if you want to take the kids out on opening weekend, take them out on opening weekend. Don't worry about yourself. You've killed enough birds. Anybody that's ever hunted with a kid knows it's more exciting than getting a turkey for yourself anyways. Mm-hmm. And I know these kids, you know, this is so near and dear to your heart at this time, but we got to go back a little bit in history. I want to hear some early days Ray I stuff. I want to hear some Johnson Mountain stories.
Oh my goodness.
I know some of the legends of Ray I from other people
now
told.
You're scaring me.
Oh, but I want to hear it from you yourself. So take me back to the early days of how this passion started for you.
Oh, wow. It's really cool. You know, I grew up in a hunting family, of course, and that's a great benefit. You know, I'm in the Ozarks and everybody hunts, and deer camp and turkey camp was a big deal. It was really a big family event. Everybody in camp was related. I started turkey hunting when I was like 9 years old. Of course, I couldn't even walk. My dad used to carry me piggyback in the woods with him to the duck blind and out squirrel hunting and did all those things. And I started competing in turkey calling contests when I was about 17, 18 years old. Back in the day, every community, every small town had a turkey calling contest. It was a big event.
What day are you talking about? What year are we talking?
Oh, we're talking 69, 70, 71, early days. All the way up through the early 80s, every community had a turkey calling contest. Well, I won some of those turkey calling contests, and people wanted to get some of my calls. So I started building. I was making calls for myself anyway. I knew a lot of people built calls, so I built calls. And then the guy comes over and says, hey, bring them by the store. So I take them to the store, and then he calls me up and says, hey, come here and show people how to use these. And I did that for a while, and then the Walmart in DeSoto, Missouri, called me and asked me if I could come down and do a demonstration. This was in 77, I guess it was. Walmart, the local store, picked up my turkey call line, and then it went into all the Walmarts. That time wasn't a lot of stores, but, you know, early Walmart. And so then I started going to all the Walmart stores doing demonstrations on how to use the calls. So I was doing the DeSoto, Potosi, and other Walmarts every spring, and it was, and you know, how times have changed, you know, the commercial brochure they put out had me with a turkey with an arrow in it, you know, try to put that in an advertisement today on hunting. So I did these promotions, and this gentleman come in a suit, and he wanted to talk to me. He asked me if I would consider doing a seminar for the college, and I didn't even know what a seminar was. And he said the guy that was going to do it was sick, and he couldn't do the deal. So I said, yeah. So he threw me on a stage with 350 people, and I was really like sucking wind at first, you know. And Ralphie Duren helped me put a slideshow together. I had plenty of slides because that's what we shot back in the day. So I was doing a slideshow. So I told a story, and everybody laughed. And next thing I know, every college in the state, I did continuing education. Kids got credit for it, and I did turkey calling classes all over state in the community colleges. And that's kind of how it started. Next thing I know, I'm in New York, Pennsylvania, California. I'm everywhere. And in 86, Hunter Specialties hired me, took my line of Ozark Mountain calls, and me and Tom Stuckey went nationwide 300 days a year doing promotions for Hunter Specialties. And that's kind of how it all started. It kind of started by accident, actually.
Well, that's a great story. But it really started in the heart of the Ozark Mountains.
Ozarks, yes. That's where it all started for me, hunting with my grandpa and my dad. And we hunted national forests a lot. It was, back then it was Mark Twain National Forest. No, it was, can't think of what it was called. It's Mark Twain now, but it was, I hate it when I do this, but they'll know what I'm talking about.
Well, I didn't know there was another name.
There was another name before it went to Mark Twain. And we hunted that because the farm was surrounded, my grandpa's farm was surrounded by national forest. And so we always hunted the national forest through those years. And we learned a lot because when I first started hunting, you never saw another turkey hunter. And then we went through that time back in the day in the 70s, late 70s, mid to late 70s, when some of the magazines, as you know, the outdoor magazines was a big deal back in those days. That's where everybody got their information. And they came down and hunted the Ozarks. In the 70s, the Ozarks was the place to go hunting turkeys because a lot of areas didn't have turkeys. A lot of states didn't have turkeys. Remember, they transplanted turkeys from the Ozarks and put them in other states. But anybody that wanted to hunt turkeys in Missouri went to the Ozarks. Well, Outdoor Life came out with an article, and it got where you couldn't park. You couldn't find a place to park. There were so many hunters in the woods to try to turkey. And they had all read this stuff where you got to run to a turkey. So you'd sit up on a turkey, and all of a sudden some guy comes running by you. So it got really tough for a lot of years down there.
Well, I think the Ozarks, they're intimidating for a lot of people.
Oh, they are. I know a lot of people in North Missouri would never hunt the Ozarks.
You look at a map and there's so much public land. But the problem is when you get down there, so much of it looks the same.
It does all look the same.
So if somebody wanted to come down and get started hunting in the Ozarks, give me some early tips or some just how to get started hunting in the Ozarks.
Get you a good topo map. I still use paper. You know, everybody's got this stuff on their phones now. But get away from the roads. Get away from the main places. Get as far back as you can. If you can find some place where the habitat changes, there's an old homestead back in the National Forest. That's a good place. Any place where there are water riverways. I loved hunting the river hills. Oh, that's good turkey hunting. Don't go to the access points where everybody else parks and try to hunt from there. You got to get away from the roads and away from people. When we've even done media hunts on the National Forest, but I took my time and scouted it by going in and finding these old logging roads on big ridges miles away from the access. And some of these places in Missouri, you can find another way in, another road in without taking the main road in, and people don't even know it's there and have great access. The main thing is it's a lot like fishing. If you stand up on Johnson Mountain and look across all those ridges and all those big hollers and big mountains all out there you go. Where do you start? There's only certain areas that always hold turkeys. And the cool thing is if the habitat doesn't change, where I hunted 30 years ago, you can go to the same spots and find turkeys. So it's like fishing on a lake. You know how you pattern a lake and try to find a fish and you find structure and where the fish are. You do the same thing with turkeys. There's certain areas that just doesn't hold the turkeys and other areas excellent, especially these old homesteads. It's just kind of like the whitetail. There's three or four different types of terrain to come together. You find a logging road that runs off in a big holler and there's plenty of water nesting for the hens, you're going to find turkeys. Some of those big ridges back in the mountains, you'll find a few turkeys, but not like you will where there's good water, cover, and edge, and timber. Any big ridge in the Ozarks where three or four ridges junction together, sit down right there. That's a good spot to kill a turkey.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of those.
Yeah, there is.
I try to encourage so many people to come down to the Ozarks and experience just how incredible the entire area is. I mean, it's so vast and there's so much opportunity. I think some people are still confused by how the public land works, but in most of these areas, you can just pull off on the side of the road. And as long as it's, you know, known to be public land,
you're fine.
You don't have to check in. You don't have to have a permit.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, do anything special. As long as you're a licensed hunter and legal in your methods, you just park your car and go.
And one of the things that I want to say, I said earlier about in the early days when the magazines was out and with so many people, I don't find it anymore. We've done several media hunts in the Ozarks in the last 10 years. We don't see another hunter when we get away from the roads and get in those public areas, especially during the week. A lot of those areas are empty. You go in, there's nobody there. And we kill a lot of turkeys in the public areas and save the private areas for later in the season.
Have you ever done a float camp?
Oh, yes. Love the float turkey hunt. I've done it with Billy Smith several times. I had a media hunt on the river where we did the boats. And I've done it both in boat and canoe in a small area on the Piney. And then we did, like a John boat. But the fun one was the boats with Billy Smith, the big boat where you could pack the lunch, pack all the stuff and your tables and everything. And you got a boat where you can cover a lot of ground, but then you shut it off and you float and you call.
Mm-hmm.
And you make them gobble, you take the beach and you go in. And that really works well because then you find mushrooms. and you find turkeys, and you can do a little fishing.
And Billy Smith, he's guiding now.
He's got a service down there, and man, what a great guy it is. Good guy to go with.
What's it called?
I can't remember what it's called right now. Here we go.
But Billy Smith out of Summer.
We're in turkey camp. I'm not supposed to remember anything. We're
trying
tired.
To give you a shout out, Billy.
Yeah, Billy does a great job. But I think it's Scenic River Tours or something like that. Yeah, I believe it is.
But he's out of Summersville.
Yeah, out of Summersville is where he's at now. Boy, he knows the river. That's one thing that I really enjoy going with Billy when I don't have a lot of people with me, is that he knows that area. He tells you what's in this holler and that what building used to be here and what's here, and he can take you. But he knows the structure. He knows the fish. That boy can catch smallmouth, goggle. He knows how to do it.
Well, that's what's special about so many of those people down there that have spent their whole lives. It's like they're part of that landscape.
They are part of that landscape.
You know, it's generational. Their roots run deep. And somehow it's almost like a monarch butterfly.
Yeah.
That knowledge is passed on telepathically from generation to generation.
Well, just think about this. We're in a boat and you're floating. And I had the girls. I had Linda Powell from Mossberg. And I had Melanie from the Turkey Federation. And these different gals from different magazines. And we're in this boat. And they've never been on the current river. And we're floating the current river at daylight with the mist coming off the mountain and the fog on the river, and they're hearing the wild turkey gobble. If you hear a wild turkey in the Ozarks gobble on the riverways, there's nothing like it. And then they got to see the wild horses, hear turkeys, float the river, see country they've never seen. And they told me that was their all-time favorite hunt of any place they've ever been. And I always tell everybody, I said, you know, I've been really, really fortunate that I do this for a living. It's hard to believe. I've hunted 42 states and Campeche, Mexico, and Old Mexico, and every place else. But to me, to this day, there's still nothing like an Ozark gobbler at daylight on a big side of a mountain someplace in the riverways.
Well, my favorite eastern hunt came from one of your media hunts, and we were down there on the Big Piney. I'll never forget it. I have that bird full body mounted, and one of the biggest birds I ever killed. We got that great picture together by that red bud blooming out right there on the banks of the Big Piney. But in case you don't remember the story, I'll rehash it.
That'd be great.
We were up on the bluff about 1:30 on opening day, and we're looking down at that big, long green field.
Right.
And then birds were out there strutting like crazy, and it'd been raining real hard, and the piney was swollen. And I said, man, if only we had permission to hunt over there. And you're like, we can hunt over there, but how are you going to get over there?
Yeah.
I said, I'll swim that river. And you looked at me, and Bobby looked at me, and everybody's like, oh, you know, who brought this kid to camp? Yeah. Right? Next morning, I put waders on, and I tiptoed across there in the dark, and it almost went over my waders. But I got across that river, and I killed one of those birds the next morning. It was just one of the greatest hunts.
Isn't that a beautiful valley right there where that river runs through there with that big bluff? Is there anything any prettier than that?
It's just one of the prettiest places I've ever been. When you sit up on that bluff and look out across that river and that just lush green field, and there's birds out there strutting, it's just magical.
That's been a great camp on the Piney down there for years. Bobby Whitehead with Outdoor Guide Magazine, all of us guys. Spence Turner,
Mark
great
Strand.
Camps. Oh, my goodness, great camps. Yeah. Good times.
Yeah, that bird, that one will be hard to top for me for my Eastern. I'm trying now to take one of all six subspecies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm heading down to Texas here to hunt with a good friend of mine, Russell Graves, and chase after
Rio. You need to come to Hawaii and take a Rio.
I do want to come to Hawaii.
I can hook you up.
That would I see your exploits from Hawaii on Facebook, and man,
I can't stay away. I'm going again next year.
So one thing I am trying to do is I created this quest for myself. It's called 50 in 50 by 50, A Hunter's Quest to Experience America. And I'm going to try to write a coffee table type book about this someday. And on my 50th birthday, which will be January 25th, 2029, I want to be in Hawaii where I end this quest with my 50th animal in my 50th state.
That would be great.
And maybe
that's quite a quest. I like that.
Yeah. I don't think turkey season's open yet, but I was always planning on killing a boar and doing a luau to celebrate the end of the quest on my 50th birthday. And then write about traveling the whole country to hunt. So
that
you said you've hunted
cool.
42 states.
Yeah.
My goal is to hunt all 50 by the time I'm 50.
You can do that.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, and it's not just hunt them. I actually have to take something.
Take a bird.
In all those states. Not a bird. It could be anything. Like I've done deer, quail, turkeys, alligators in Louisiana, whatever. And it's all about like going and experiencing those different cultures. Like what happens in this state? What is it? Like I shot groundhogs in the Smoky Mountains with a moonshiner in North Carolina.
That's awesome.
There's a story there.
Yeah.
You know, I shot a turkey in New York. alligators in Louisiana, turkey in South Dakota, pronghorn in Wyoming. I lived in Montana. And so, you know, it's going to be a diverse kind of array of what I've been able to do as I traveled across the country, meeting interesting people and visiting cool places.
That's great. I was real fortunate to be able to hunt all these states from turkey calling contests because I met so many people and great friends in the turkey calling circuit. We ended up, you know, I knew them good, and I'd go to stay at their home and go hunt their state. And then doing seminars all over the country and traveling, doing shows, I met so many people that have become family. So I had access to great places to hunt in all these different states from my traveling. So it worked really well for me. That's how I was able to cover so many states.
Well, it's interesting to be sitting here with you now because I read your books and I watched you on Hunter Specialties. And,
well, that's
you
cool,
know, that whole crew of you guys, I mean, I got to be good friends with Philip Vanderpool. And yeah. I know Alex as well, and a couple of the other guys that were on that crew. And boy, they really did a good job of putting together some guys back in.
Great time. Those were good days.
The glory days.
Yeah, it was the glory days.
Everybody had a TV
Man,
show.
We had some miles. We run some miles. Me and Tom Stuckey, oh my gosh, I cannot believe the miles that we went.
It's interesting. I'm glad to see you working with Midwest Outdoors now. That's a TV show that I grew up on. I mean, long before we even had cable in our household, I was waking up to watch Midwest Outdoors on a UHF channel out of Chicago back in the mid-80s, early 90s, you know, and never forget Gene Lawland and saying, it's a keeper. But then hunting shows, just a few of them kind of started to come up. The early ones, you know, Night and Hail.
Right.
You guys with HS, Real Tree, and Mossy Oak came in. And I can't claim not to be part of the problem because I ended up taking a job in marketing for a major brand in the outdoor space. But man, it just got diluted. It really feels
it really
like,
did.
You know, it went from being educational and quality
teaching
to ego and everybody trying to do it. And
we call that the look at me syndrome.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Like today, I don't even have the Outdoor Channel or the Sportsman's Channel anymore. It became so different than what I was interested in. Like it was no longer about like how to go here and hunt this place or the meaning behind it all. It was just like who could kill the biggest buck. And then you start seeing these guys go down like dominoes, breaking laws and poaching and
anything to get a show type thing. And I've talked a lot about that, and I've done story times about that, and I've talked a lot about that on the radio. That's not what it's all. It's education, sharing with others, share what you know. But there was always a storyline, and you did teaching and you shared what you have learned. Well, I did this, and this is what happened, and this is why I did it. Instead of that, it was like, and I go back to it again, look at me, look at me.
Yeah, and it's good to see that when I get to meet guys like you that have been in it for so long, you know, who came up in it doing it the right way, to see you wanting to take a weekend and spend it with kids that you
absolutely
don't even know and giving of your time. And I just want to tell you, I appreciate that.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I love doing this. You know, I've actually done youth hunts over 30 years. Like we're doing, not quite like the governor's hunt, but I mean, organized youth hunts. And we did drawings for kids, and it makes me so proud. And I just well up when I look at this. We did a youth deer hunt, a youth turkey hunt, and both of those at Monty's Outdoors and with Midwest Outdoors and with the Ozark Radio Network and 590 The Fan, who I'm with. We put that together. Over 1,000 kids registered for that. We drew the winner and took them turkey hunting.
I remember watching a clip with you, and you had like three different girls, and they were all kind of like early teenagers, maybe.
Oh, yeah. 12, 14, and 15.
Tell that story.
Oh, what a great story that is. Those kids were so awesome. Well, I went out to Kansas in September for a Jake's event, the state Jake's event, National Wild Turkey Federation. They asked me to do a seminar out there. Great bunch of kids. I knew I was wanting to shoot a show, and I wanted to interview and get some of these kids on my radio programming. So I'm watching these kids. One little girl won the calling contest. She was really good. But their personality, I had one little gal that I wasn't around her 10 minutes, and I said, I need to hunt with this girl. I need to have her on TV, and she needs to be on the radio. Her personality was incredible. Great kid. So I had these kids chosen, and I hadn't talked to the people that were running the state event at this time yet. After I did the seminar, I had a girl come up to the front. She says, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. She goes, will you take me turkey hunting? And I said, to take you turkey hunting? She goes, yeah. She says, nobody in my family hunts, and I came with some friends to this turkey thing, and I really like it. And I watched your seminar, and I really want to go turkey hunting. She goes, and I'll pay you if you take me turkey hunting. And I said, give me your name and address, honey. And I said, I can't promise you that. And, you know, I get this a lot, but I get this, and I talked to her a little bit more, and she had a great personality. So I go over to see the guys that's running this, and I don't mean nothing bad about them, but they said, hey, we got an idea. Why don't you come back in May and go turkey hunting with us? And I said, why don't I come back in May and go turkey hunting with these kids? I said, I want to hunt with these girls. I don't want no boys. I want to hunt with these girls. So I was talking to them, and I said, I want this girl and this girl. And I said, do you know this girl? He says, no. I said, I want to hunt with her. So we took her on a hunt. So I told her I'd take her on a hunt. And we went out to Kansas. We did late season Kansas. And the dad and the guy running it and the guy with me, they all wanted to go to the blind with us. Now, this is late May. And I said, no, you all got to stay up the truck. I'll take care of the girls. I drove around with them the evening I got there and looked at the area, and I saw the turkeys in the field. And I said, can we hunt this field? They said, yes. So we went in and put a blind up in the dark. And I took those kids and put them in that blind and got in there with the camera. And those kids experienced something. Let me tell you, those girls all experienced something that many adult turkey hunters have never seen. Never heard a hen, never saw a hen. It was late May. The gobblers were getting back together, and there was a lot of pecking order going on. And I called a gobbler in right at light. The gobbler come across the field, and he squatted in the field with a full fan, still strutting, but sat down on the ground. So I was telling the girls what he was doing. He's subordinate. There was another gobbler coming to field. Gobbler coming to field. He got up, chased it off. Then a jake come to field. That gobbler chased the jake off. Anyway, long story short, he did the squat thing with the fan three times until a bad boy come into field and whipped him, run him around. Well, I kept gobbler yelp. I never made a hen sound. I had two gobbler decoys out in front of the blinds. These two kids never killed a turkey. Three kids in the blind, two of them on the gun. The big gobbler that came in and whipped the first one that came in, they come around and then turned and marched into the gun. And they marched straight at us, full frame, full video. And I said, you girls ready? They said, yeah. I said, on three, one, two, three, boom, boom, double on camera. These kids, girls, are you kidding me? How cool. And the little gal that was in there, when the jake ran off, she missed him. So when they come out of the blind, I said, what'd you do? She said, I killed a turkey. What'd you do? She said, I missed a turkey. So what'd you do? I killed a turkey. I took the other little girl, that she was 13 at the time, the next morning, called two gobblers in that attacked the decoys at 15 yards, and she took a big gobbler. I got three turkeys for these three girls all on camera. That doesn't happen. And I'm still great friends with these kids, love these kids, talk to them all the time.
Yeah, I remember it reminded me of a clown car at the circus.
Yeah.
One came out, another came
out. Yeah, they just kept coming out of the blind.
Like, how did you have so many
people?
Let me
tell you, you should have been in that blind with these three girls. Oh, my gosh. I had the camera set in the middle. I had a kid on each side and one behind me, and then we'd switch out. You know, oh, what a great time. Good kids.
Speaking of clowns, I think there's a few stories about you floating around out there.
Yeah, the feral clown. We've had more fun with that. It all started some years ago. We had an outdoor rider media hunt, and Cabela's was a sponsor. And a gentleman, I just won't say his last name, but Scott came down and showed a weakness. Told me that he had a phobia about clowns. And it kind of started right there. And after we scared the bejesus out of him with a clown, it started growing where we were scaring more and more people with the clown. I had a great...
But with a clown is with you with a mask
on. And we actually ended up with a full suit, you know, with the hoop skirt, the bow tie, the big shoes, all of it, top hat. And we had a clown with teeth. We had all these different clowns. And it went from there. We called it the feral clown. Yeah. And we did some radio shows where we interviewed the feral clown. Some magazine articles came out. Anyway, it spread.
Wasn't it in Field and Stream?
It was in Field and Stream. And that was with Bill Heavey because he was in a media camp where the clown showed up. And he asked me the story about the best scare ever. And it was when we had the young man on the deer hunt with his dad. The kid got his first deer when he was little, and then he got older, and he got to be a little bit of a smart guy, you know. He kind of popped off to his Uncle Ray. So I told him, Dad, I said, look, I got to go home, so why don't you guys hunt my TV blind for deer? And all that. He was just beside himself, and I didn't go home. I had full clown. I was in the blind when this kid showed up the next morning.
In the dark.
In the dark, pitch black. And I heard his dad say, you need to really thank your Uncle Ray for letting us have this. This is unbelievable. We get to hunt here. He said, now, you back in there and get your chair. Here's a light. He had a little green light. And he said, then I'll hand your gun in. But when he backed in and turned around, I was sitting on the chair in a full clown with the teeth. And I went, I've been waiting for you. And he literally ran through the blind because he couldn't get back. Broke the rods in it, tipped it over. And I jumped up and I had a green light because I had it on my face under the chin. You know, you shine it up. And Dad was on his back crawling backwards. He wasn't helping the kid. The kid, I took pictures. I still got photos of that blind in the field where he ran through it and broke the rods in it. It was so funny. By that time, the clown had got very popular. And I called double bull blinds at that time. You know, and I said, I got some broken rods. How many you need? And I started telling him about the rods were broken. He said, well, I'll just send you a bundle. And he goes, by the way, what happened to your blind? I said, clown damage. He goes, oh, okay, I'll get those right out to you. So, I mean, it didn't even affect him. But there were so many stories there. So many guys have seen the clown in different situations, but one of them was at the cabin on the Piney, and the Missouri Outdoor Communicators were down, okay? So they were down, and I had a bad boy buggy, and I had the full clown. I had to deal with the teeth. And there was one of the members was going to be floating in a red canoe. Bobby Whitehead said, such and such. And I said, oh, I'm going to get him with the clown. So I took the buggy across the river, hit it, and I got in where it turns, his little channel turns to the right, and it narrows. And I was laying down in the weeds there in the cattails waiting for the red canoe. I saw the red canoe, and I come up out of the brush with the clown, charged the canoe with the teeth and stuff. And it wasn't the guy in the red canoe. It was three girls in a canoe, and they're screaming and going sideways and paddling. And I go, oh, my God. And I run back. I grab the buggy, and I run up in the woods, and I hide for a while. And I come back, and the guy is sitting there. And I come in, and I go, Bobby, what happened? He said, oh, he didn't go. I said, who was in a red canoe? He says, I don't know. But the story, long short of this, is in town in Licking, Missouri, at the local place, there's a big table where the locals, and Bobby Whitehead was with me. I have a witness. We went in the next morning. There was a guy at the table, hitting the table, says, I'm telling you, there was a clown on the river yesterday. They were talking about it in the cafe.
Oh, man. What you can become known for.
Oh, unbelievable. The years we've done the clown, it's just – this, you never knew where he's going to pop up.
Is he retired?
He's been semi-retired, but he's kind of laying back. He's waiting for the right moment. He will reappear, promise you that.
The clown has a future.
Yeah, he looked in the window one time at a cabin, had to get up on the buggy to look through the window, and the guy knocked the lamp over and stuff. And then when the guys were in there and he came in, he had his bags packed, and they said, where are you going? You got 3 days. He goes, I got a lot of work to go. And he left the camp. Never said anything to anybody about the clown. He left.
The clown ruins camps and double bull blinds.
Destroys double bull blinds.
All right. Well, I got to get back to getting serious. So I've got some guys coming in for turkey season this year that I'm interested in impressing these guys. You know, they're coming in from Seattle and Montana. And, you know, I've been really talking the Ozarks up. I'm telling them, like, look, you know, I lived in Montana. I know how beautiful it is. I know what you guys are dealing with out there. But this place is special. You got to understand the history of it all.
Right.
The fact that these birds were the birds that were used for the restoration of most eastern states, for most midwestern states. There's this incredible story here. But at the same time, I want to make sure that we get on some birds.
Right.
And that it appears that I know what I'm talking about. Because I'm pretty green down there. You know, I've killed a bunch of birds on ag fields in the northern part of the state and Indiana. And I've killed some birds out west. But I've only killed a few down in the Ozarks. And I'm talking a big game, so give me some big Ray Eye tips. I know two things. I know Ray Eye says calling is everything.
Absolutely.
And roosting is the key to success.
It really is. Roosting is what makes it happen for me for my media hunt. So
let's start with roosting.
Roosting, if you could get down and listen to the turkeys from a distance and hear them gobbling when they wake up in the morning, listen to them. Not just at daylight, but where do they go, where are they at 10 o'clock, and learn as much about those turkeys as you can in those areas that you're going to hunt. But if you could roost those turkeys and find out not only where they roost, and I'm not talking about staying back 200 yards, hear one fly up and gobble. I mean, finding out which tree he's in, which direction he flies up from. You got to put a lot of work into roosting. But, you know, I do it traveling for television shows and these outdoor media hunts. You know, I do 9 states a spring, and I'd go into a place in the dark, 3 a.m. I've never seen in my life. And they put me in there. Well, I use the calling to locate and find out what the turkeys are doing. But if I can get in there, if I get in there in the dark the first day, the next night I'm roosting because I heard the turkeys that morning. Or if I come to a new place, if I can get there a day ahead of time, I go in. Roosting teaches me everything I need to know about the turkeys.
So is there a small window of time where you can roost birds?
Time, if it's open country, well, you're talking Ozarks, but if it's open country, don't go too early because you'll bump them. You want to get it right at dark when they start flying up. But if you can get in open country and stay back, if you got fields, watch them where they leave the field, right at dark. Then once they go in and it gets dark, go down to that corner. But stay hidden, stay back a little bit in the cover, and then owl or turkey call. I do mostly.
So you get down to that corner. And
I call. And usually turkey calling makes them gobble on the roost way better than owl hooting.
Loud, soft?
No, just call like a turkey. They'll answer just like what the hens do. And I'll cut and yelp, and I'll even do a fly-up cackle. And I've got some video segments where we're standing 50 yards from gobblers up in the roost, and I'll cut and cackle on a call, and there everybody's gobbling. You hear me tell my guy, well, we got a rooster. We better go. We're both laughing. But if you can follow them to the roost, and in the ridge country in Ozarks, wherever you've heard turkeys before, get in those areas in the evening and listen for them to fly up. You can hear a turkey in the Ozarks fly up a long ways off. Big birds make a lot of noise. But there's a way that they fly up, and a lot of times in the hill country, they fly from a ridge or bench. They'll go to the end of a ridge and pitch out on a tree that's down on the side of the hill. So 9 out of 10, because they're turkeys, they'll pitch back on that same point, and that's where you need to be. You don't want to be on any other side of that turkey. I learned that years ago. Come in below a turkey, and he's gobbling on the side of the hill, and he pitches down right up on the side of that ridge or on the bench.
So I've got an area that's a real long ridge, big ridge.
Now imagine that ridge is kind of running along where your knuckles are, and then there's three fingers. So imagine
start right there.
Your first three fingers are going down, and the fingers go down into a real deep holler,
mm-hmm.
and there's a creek down at the bottom.
They got to be roosting right in there, right off one of those fingers.
So if you just get up on that.
Get up on there and listen and call with a turkey call in the evening. And if you can listen from a distance and see where they wake up, because in the spring, you know, the turkeys break up, the gobblers are in different spots. They got a favorite roosting place, so the hens can hear them, and where they can talk to the other birds. That's why they like to be off the end of those hills, you know, the big hollers and stuff, and those big, they can hear all the way. You hear turkeys gobbling around both sides. They're there for a reason. They'll pitch back the way they came up. They're not normally going to pitch down in the valley or pitch from the valley and get up in the tree. They're going to come off the top and fly out to a tree. A lot of times they roost straight level with where they pitch off, where the tree's down below, and getting those big limbs. I can tell you one from 1973 down at my grandpa's. It was my Uncle Mont's place. There was a ridge we call Buford Ridge. And on that ridge, the turkey would gobble out on this glade. He'd strut on the glade. Well, I was trying to figure him out. Well, when he strutted on that glade, then he'd go back up on the hill, and he'd pitch out from the side of the ridge onto a tree that was way down, kind of off the side of the hill. And he was level with where he flew from. And he only had to flutter 30 feet to be on a big limb. But if you were down in the field or on the ridge below him and hear him gobbling, you'd set up and call and call, and you'd never kill him. He'd never come to you. He'd just flutter back on that ridge, and that's where he did his thing, and then he'd strut out to the glade. I learned that from that turkey. So I went down there in 1973. I had a 66 Chevelle, okay, 396.
What a hunting
day. I had to be to work. I was working at that time. I had to be at work up on Manchester, Lindell Bumper. I had to be at work at 8 o'clock. And I was at Johnson Mountain in a 396 Chevelle, and it was raining. I mean raining. I was listening to Brown Sugar on the radio. I'll never forget it. And I woke up, and it was right at light, and the rain had stopped, and I heard him gobble. And I got out of the car and went up through that field, hit the creek, went up, hit the ridge, and didn't go where anybody else would set up on him. And I climbed the hill and got on the hill right level with him, just pretty close. And I just tree called to him, clucked a few times. I saw the limb bounce, heard him wing. He lit the ground. I killed him when his feet touched the ground. I grabbed him, ran back down the hill, threw him in a 396 Chevelle, and I was at work at 8 o'clock on Manchester, 4211 Manchester, Lindell Bumper.
That's a good story. So if you go right at dusk.
Perfect time.
Can you be too late as well?
They'll still gobble in the tree, but I want to hear them fly up, and I want them to talk a little bit. And some nights, they're all different. Some evenings, they'll gobble in the dark. I went back and cut at them at 10 o'clock at night and had them gobble, so if a moonlit night. But if you can get right at dark when they're flying up, they like to talk. They'll talk in the evening. A lot of people say people won't turkey call to them. People on an owl hoot. They'll stand back 200 yards, 300 yards on the logging road now. Woo-hoo! Now listen, they hear one and they're high-fiving and they got him roosted. They don't have him roosted. You got to get him roosted. And like in New England and every place I go, I'll follow a turkey to the roost. I'll keep him gobbling with a call until he flies up. And I watch where he flew up from. And I'll do the same thing in the Ozarks. But the cool thing about the Ozarks is when you get in those hills, if you know that area and you know where you generally hear turkeys at daylight, focus on those particular points and get into that place where you heard those turkeys gobble. He's roosting right there someplace. He's got a favorite roostery. And they'll do, unless they get bumped or a lot of pressure, they'll be there every night. You go to the same spot. So I could actually, where I roosted turkeys in the 70s, if the habitat hadn't changed, the trees are still there, we could go there this turkey season. There'd be a gobbler in that tree. And I killed a lot of turkeys like that through the years by going to places that I hunted 10 years before where I killed turkeys.
So let's say you go back and you try to roost a bird,
mm-hmm.
but you don't. And you've got an area figured out that's maybe a couple thousand acres,
okay.
which isn't a lot when you consider how big some of these big conservation mm-hmm. areas and Mark Twain National Forest is. And you've heard some birds gobble throughout the day. You know there's birds in that area.
Right.
And you've got your topographical map. You don't have a bird roosted. How do you start the next morning?
I go right to that spot where you heard it before. And as soon as it's got enough light, you can barely see, start cutting on a mouth call.
Okay, let's say that you've never heard one before. Like
I'd still do the same.
You're looking at a topographical map. You've got access to this, you know, couple thousand acres. What are you looking for on a topographical map? Where are you trying to
start? I'm looking where ridges come together.
Are you going as high as you can?
Not always as high as you can. It's where, if there's a long ridge with other ridges that join it, which is a lot of those, not the main ridge, but where it starts dumping off and then other ridges come in where there's habitat change and like there's old homesteads or clearings. Or clear cuts where there's a difference in habitat, food plots, a clearing. Find those areas like that. And like if three ridges come together, you come to it down a ridge and then there's three ridges junction, that's a good place to start right there. That's a great place to call and set up both to call and kill turkey plus to locate turkeys.
So I know an area that has a really nice little spring creek coming through it
mm-hmm.
and it's pretty lush down in there and it's off two really steep ridges. One almost looks like a backbone.
I mean, that ought to be awesome.
You go down into those bottoms, or do you start up?
Always start high. Stay away from the creek. Stay up high.
And then if you hear them, then you go down into the bottoms after them.
You can if they go to the bottom, but usually if you hear them, if you're up high and you hear them, they're off the end of those points, and usually they go back out those points. Now, they'll follow hens during the day. They'll make their routes, and they'll be at the bottom. But most of the time, they don't fly up the roost and fly straight down to the bottom. They'll pitch off on a ridge, and they'll work that ridge for hens. And that's what they do in the Ozarks. They look for hens. Just like an example, he's talking about the cabin on the Piney a while ago where you killed your turkey. Mm-hmm. If you cross the river, get into that field, and you go straight across the field, there's a big ridge to your left right there. Now, that turkey gobbles on the front side of that ridge onto that field. You can hear him all over that field. You can hear him from the cabin. You can hear him everywhere. But he doesn't come off that ridge and come down in that field. He goes out that ridge, and he gobbles out that ridge to where it joins other ridges, and then he works that for hens and calls hens to him. So you're not going to kill him from the field. You're not going to kill him off the end of that point. You got to get up on the ridge with him, and that's how I killed him. I got up on the ridge with him where two junctions of ridges come together and got around and sat there, and he gobbled off that end of the ridge, and the other guys were calling at him at the field. And when I called, he flew where he flies down every day, came straight down that ridge right to me, and I killed him.
So let's say kind of the prime time in the morning gets past you. You've not had any success so far. You know, we're talking 10, 11, 12 o'clock.
Good time to be hunting.
Yeah. Where are you heading at that time of the day?
Don't get skylighted is the main thing in the hill country. You don't want to get skylighted. Try to stay off the side of the hills a little bit. It's hard to do with the big logging roads, but I'd like to get, if I'm going to get someplace where I'm going to call, I'll get off this logging road and get off the side of the hill where I can see the logging road and the bench. We can see both of them. Don't set up right on the logging road because those turkeys, they run them logging roads. And I move and call. I'll call. I'll stay a while. Casey doesn't gobble. I started lots of them like that. And I'll move and call. Let's say this ridge we're talking about runs a mile or whatever, three-quarter mile or a mile. And I'm calling out through there. And I'll turn around, come back, and sit down in the same place. A lot of time I'll kill him on the way back.
How long do you sit before you move?
That's hard to say. Just sit till you can't stand it no longer, stand a little longer. I don't know, you know, 30 or 40 minutes. I mean, you're on turkey time. You're not on people time.
How often do you call?
A lot. I don't know how often it is. I try to sound like a turkey. I start easy and I build a little bit and I get a little more excited. Now, I don't like to use the term aggressive because I don't really know what that is. That's a different terminology depending on different opinions of different people. But I try to do like what the turkeys do.
Yeah, you read like a magazine article and it's every 5 minutes.
No, you can't do it. Turkeys don't wear watches. You can't do that. You got to call with feeling and emotion, but you got to listen and watch too. You can't just keep calling all the time. And I understand that because I had a gentleman that contacted me that read my book and he wanted to know if I ever stopped calling. Do I call continuously when they're on the roost? And he misinterpreted my book. No, that wasn't what I was trying to express to you. I don't continually call nonstop while he's on the roost and as loud as I can call. But moving and calling is a great thing to do in the hills, especially that 10, 11, 12 o'clock time. Because if you get one to gobble at you, you better hang tight. Because if there's a good chance he answers that late in the morning, he's coming.
If you have these logging roads or kind of, you know, real rural county roads, mm-hmm. gravel roads that are running back through the forest, and there's some traffic back in there, so these birds have never heard a vehicle before stuff. Like, how far do you think you need to park away from where you start hunting? Or if you drive one of those, can you drive one of those forest roads and call?
Absolutely. That's what we started doing. We used to go to one holler and turkey hunt. But then the turkey, what as many turkeys, things changed. A lot of people came in and hunted. And I learned in a Jeep down there that you could take these roads and drive 300 yards to get out and hit a call. If you get one to gobble, then just leave it there and just move off in toward the turkey. And we'd find turkeys place to place by moving and calling. We used to do it on foot, but you cover more ground. You got more chances of finding turkeys. And we always used to drive a Jeep and go from place to place and find turkeys. And we'd move. Let's say we called four places, heard nothing. You pull up on this old road and all of a sudden you hit it and there's a turkey gobbles. You got to know the area. And if you know that area, you heard him gobble there before, you know how you want to set up on him. But I struck a lot of turkeys. Like, I've killed a lot of turkeys with outdoor riders instead of walking all morning because a lot of them couldn't really walk and that country was rough. We just took those old roads in a Jeep and I'd start a turkey. Then we'd move away from the Jeep and set up and call him in and kill him. We killed a lot of them like that. We've had them come right down the road at us.
So you don't think if a turkey's 200 yards away and he hears the Jeep
ain't going to bother him. No.
Not at all.
No. They hear it all the time. It ain't going to bother him. If it did, I don't think we'd ever kill them. We killed them for years like that.
Right.
I mean, I don't run a four-wheeler up there or something that makes a lot of noise. It's just an old Jeep. Just idle along, get out. Because I've parked a Jeep before. I've stopped and got out of a Jeep, stepped in front of the Jeep, hit a box call, and he, blew my hat off. We had to hurry and get away from the Jeep and got off the side of the road and sat down and called him right up and killed him.
Speaking of calling, that's the other aspect that I really want to talk to you about. Started a little bit, but when you say calling is everything, you know, the average hunter is going out with a box call or
great call,
you know, a real basic understanding of how to use a mouth call. I mean, it's not as complicated as a lot of people try to make it out to be.
No, it's not. Just try to sound like a turkey and have turkey rhythm. You're going to call turkeys. Box call, I tell everybody use a box call, especially beginning hunters. It's in one piece. You know, the pot calls, the slates, the glasses, they're great, but you got a striker and you got a thing. You got to put them together and rub it, you know, strike, you know, pull it, make a circle. With a box call, it's one piece. You got a lid and a bottom, and it stays together, and you just drag it across the edge. You ought to heard our kid that's never turkey hunted box calling today. He was awesome. He sounded just like a turkey.
Yeah.
And he's never even done it before. So that's what you got to do. But always start soft, and whatever soft, not very loud, and build it and then get a little more excited and a little more excited, get a little more loud. And, you know, and I'm saying, you know, yelp 4 or 5 times, but then yelp like 15 times.
I always compare that to fishing a stream in the sense that you want to fish the water closest to you first.
Yeah.
So you're basically fishing
for the
turkeys that are closest to you first.
Right.
You know, you don't want to overcall to something that might be 50 yards away, trying to reach something that could be 200 yards away.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't matter with turkeys. Sometimes you could blow a call as loud as you want, and he's at 50 yards, and he gobbles and runs over you. Another time, you know. But, yeah, the basic thing is to start easy and call and then build it and keep building. That's what I do. I start easy and I build and I get louder and I get longer yelps. You want to get what I call begging. You don't want to sound the same. You don't want to go yelk, 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 yelk. You want to go yelk, 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 pop, pop, yelk, 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 pop, pop, because you're trying to find another turkey.
So
put that in your calling.
Basically, yelps are what you're starting with when you're searching. Yeah.
And then I'll do pop, pop, do the pop, pops or cuts, whatever you want to call them.
So the putting's one thing that always kind of confuses me because that's their call when they're
never also even worry about that. That's been overplayed, overdone, oversaid. I've never scared a turkey with a putt. I've killed more turkeys with a putt. You're not going to scare a turkey with that.
So aren't they telling other turkeys to be alarmed when they start putting?
No. Yeah. When they go put, put, and they're leaving, but you're not doing that. You're going pop, 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 pop. Something they do every day. They putt every day. They talk. They communicate. A cluck is contentment. Put. A putt is an excited cluck. Put, put. And cutting is an excited putting. Put, 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 put. And if you listen to turkeys, when they get worked up, even old gobblers do that, their tone is higher pitched, and they do it faster. And I've never, ever worried about scaring a turkey by doing a putt, ever, in my entire lifetime.
Do you ever gobble?
Yes. I gobble today. Yeah, I do a Jake yelp and I'll gobble on them. Just I can't do it now. I'm hoarse from day, but I can't do it tonight, buddy.
That sounds all right.
I can't do it. I keep stopping.
But what's the purpose of that?
Challenge pecking order. You're working on pecking order. That's why a gobbler yelp. You lengthen your yelp and slow it down. You challenge turkeys. Like right now, these gobblers I saw were chasing each other. If I could have got a better position and got set up on them, got some gobbler yelp on them, I believe we could have killed one of them, but we couldn't move today with the open woods and we were in a shooting house, you know.
So will gobblers react similar to like a buck deer when you're grunting at them?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah. I've killed more turkeys with a gobbler yelp than I ever have with hen yelping because you got a small window of opportunity when a hen and a gobbler, hen calls to a gobbler. And that's how spring turkey season is judged by the mating season. That's a small window of opportunity. What if it's an early season or late season? Well, the gobblers are still running together. Hen yelp don't do you much good. That's what I was talking about Kansas a while ago. Never used a hen call. If you'd have gotten that blind with those kids, those girls we talked about in a hen call, you wouldn't have killed a turkey. I killed a turkey because we gobbler yelped.
What's the difference between a hen yelp and a gobbler yelp? A
gobbler yelps longer in length, a little slower rhythm sometimes. Sometimes they call as fast as a hen. They know what it is. It's just a hen's not cow, 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 and a gobbler's not cow, 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 cow. Just lengthen the yelp.
Just lengthen.
Wish I could call. Man, I'm so hoarse. I still can't gobble.
No, that sounds all right. So it's a longer yelp? Is it a deeper yelp?
Not necessarily deeper. They're high-pitched too, but it's just a longer yelp. And your rhythm is sometimes a little slower. But if they answer me, I get more excited. But they do a lot of cutting. Adult gobblers cut a lot. People don't realize it. They think it's hens.
And you can work that out on a box call?
Box call, slate call, mouth call. Do it on all of them.
But you're usually running a mouth call.
I run all of them. I run a box call a lot, too. Box call sounds like a turkey.
Do you have any of them old Ozark box calls?
I got one. A guy brought to me at the Turkey Federation show because I said I didn't have one anymore, and he went and found me one and brought me one.
Man, there's a guy that makes them down in Eminence. He's proud of them, though. They're expensive.
Like, oh, yeah.
$300 or something. Yeah. And I just can't seem to pony up
$300. No, you don't want to do that. A good box call, and I'll tell everybody, and everyone I've got, I went back to Nashville. Well, I was in Nashville. I went over to Booth, and I went through the calls. And there's a lot of $200, $300 box calls. There's one out there for $30, okay? $30. Legends of the Outdoors Hall of Fame box call. I hunted with it today. Everyone I pull out sounds the same. I got two more down there. I hunted with it today. It's a great call, and it's $30. You got to have one of those. I mean, they're really cool. And Cedar Hill Game Calls is the guy that's got them. And I tell you what, it is a great box call.
I'm using an old HS Strut box call that I've had for a decade, one of the waterproof versions.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of people say, oh, those don't sound as good as a chalked up box call, but it's worked well
for
me.
If you try one of these Legends box calls, it sounds like a high dollar box call. And it's very consistent. And that thing that I'm saying that impressed me about it, when I went to the table and just picked one up, did it was good, picked up another one. Then I said, I need to open some of these. And I opened them out of the package because I had some guys that wanted them. And as soon as I hit them, they were there.
You know, that's just one more thing that I really appreciate about you is the fact that so many people get caught up in the products and all the newest, most technical gear. And you're out hunting in brown canvas overalls.
Yeah, like today.
And a camo jacket. My shotgun that I use for turkey hunting, I've killed every turkey that I've ever killed with it, over 30, except for the one down in Campeche with Jorge.
Yeah, right.
And with George.
George,
yeah. And, you know, it's a 870 Express, black synthetic. It's right. Not camouflage. Turkey hunting is just not as complicated as so many people make it out to be.
Turkey hunters are their own worst enemy. They overthink, outthink, overvaluate everything, and think you got to have everything to kill a turkey. And when somebody says something to me about, hey, you didn't wear any camouflage, you can't do that, or doing a seminar, and say, hey, I saw that video clip, you didn't have a camouflage gun. Before 1983, nobody did. My grandpa, my grandma, my uncles, my dad, nobody had any camouflage. Nobody hunted in it. And I grew up in bib overalls. And now that I'm like semi-retired from the hunting industry, I'm still doing a lot of, you know, media stuff, that I don't have somebody telling me that I have to tell everybody they have to wear it. I'm back to my roots and I'm loving it. I enjoy hunting in my brown pants and my bib overalls and just enjoying the woods and sharing it with others and having a good time.
Or your Hawaiian shirts.
I killed a lot of turkeys in a Hawaiian shirt. I brought it on this trip, but I didn't get a chance to wear it yet.
You got to take me on that trip.
You got to go to Hawaii with me.
I want to.
I got really a great bad. Friend. I want you to meet him. He's going to be here this spring season in Missouri.
John?
John Sabati's coming over. I'd love you to meet him while he's here.
I would like to. Maybe we do a podcast with John.
That would be great. He'd be a great podcast.
Another thing that I think a lot of people are confused about are decoys. Right. So you even told me that you had a problem with a decoy.
This morning. I had one this morning because what was going on with the turkeys. Because right now it's early April and the gobblers are still doing their thing about who's in charge and who isn't in charge, social structure, pecking order. And we had two gobblers come in and they were by themselves. I told them as soon as I saw them, they didn't strut, they didn't gobble. They come out and they look. I had a gobbler and a hen decoy. When they saw the gobbler and hen, they left because they'd been whooped. And obviously a little later when I saw 12 hens with two gobblers strutting behind them, that's in the same place. That's exactly what that was. And then we saw four gobblers chasing another gobbler, running them all over the field. And so that decoy I set up this morning did not work. I'm convinced if that two decoys were not there this morning, we would have killed one of those turkeys.
So I'm going back into that same stand tomorrow.
Yes, you are. And don't put no decoys out.
I've got a hen and a Jake.
That could work, but I tell you, the way they reacted this morning, I don't know if I'd put out any decoys.
So that's what I was going to – so these guys that are coming in – and the listeners will know who they are here in a few weeks when we release that podcast. But they're like, we got a couple flocks of decoys. Should we bring them in?
No.
I'm thinking, you're not going to want to carry those around the Ozarks.
No, and where are you going to put them? In the woods?
Yeah, but should you carry like one hen with you?
Take one hen, and if you get on an open stretch on a logging road, put it out. Or like a food plot where a little clearing is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good place to put one hen, but I wouldn't put out a flock.
I was going to carry, I told him, I'm going to carry one hen around with me. And when we set up on a logging road or something like that, I'll stretch her out.
You know, we never used to have decoys either.
That's what I'm thinking. Is it just another marketing ploy?
It can work. There's situations where, see, it's like any of this stuff. Anything in turkey hunting can work in certain situations. In other situations, it doesn't work. But I give you an example on a decoy back in, oh, man, I don't know if it was early 80s or late 70s, a guy came out with a hard body decoy, and I'd never seen one. And he asked me, you know, would you try this? And I said, well, you know, and I said, okay. So I took it out there, and I didn't know, you know, I never knew you used a decoy for a turkey. I never heard of such a thing, you know. We run and gun, kill turkeys. So I put it out, and I stuck it in the ground, and I looked at it. I said, well, I guess it looks all right. Now I think about it. It was pretty ugly. But yeah, ugly girls need love, too. So it's out there. Sitting there in the stake in this little clearing, and the turkey gobbled, and I called, and he gobbled, he come around, and he went around the hill, and he went out the ridge gobbling. So I got up and went after the turkey and killed him. I guess the decoy is still there. I never went back.
Well, now you're seeing decoys that cost hundreds of dollars.
Oh, it's insane.
Kind of reminds me when I go down and duck hunt with my buddies at Real Foot Lake. You know, we're killing ducks over milk jugs painted black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, Right. How intricate does this turkey decoy need to be? And you see guys that are, you know, using taxidermy decoys and
stuffed turkeys, like, mounted turkeys.
It just seems like overkill to me.
There's a place and time for any type of hunting equipment that it can work. And the decoys with the blinds, like with kids, and I like the bow hunters, they completely change bow hunting turkeys because they shoot them out of a blind with decoys. That's fine. But there's a time when those decoys work extremely well. And the thing that I get out of it, and I keep telling everybody, what you're doing now with strutting decoys and male decoys is what I do with gobbler yelping and have for 40 years. And you're getting the same result, but you're using a decoy. I get the same result from that turkey by yelping like a gobbler at him. I had a guy come to me with a strutting decoy in the early 80s, and nobody would touch it. I took it to a lot of companies. I took it to Flambeau, and they wouldn't touch it because of accidents, because they didn't want you to have a turkey to look like a turkey out in front of you.
Well, now you see those guys fanning them. I seen a video of a guy the other day, a hunting celebrity who shot a turkey in the face with a pistol at
and there's a time frame.
Three or four
steps. Guy's sitting there watching that on television, okay? There's a certain time in the cycle of turkey, if you got open fields, try that in the Ozarks where you're at, in an open field where that does work. There's times that, but it's not going to work every time. But the guys watching on TV don't know that, so they take it out all the time and try it, and they're very disappointed. You read some of the blogs and look at some of the Facebook posts, the guys are like, wow. You know, that's another thing you can do. But for me, in my training and growing up and with hunter education and teaching hunter education classes, that's don't wear white, white, and blue. Don't walk around with a turkey fan. Why don't you wear deer antlers and a deer hide in deer season?
Don't crawl around with a turkey fan
in front of your face. Yeah.
Which kind of takes us to a product that I do feel is important. And yesterday at the training, so we had 20 youths shooting at the range under real serious instruction from trained hunter education instructors and Department of Conservation staff. But I got to see basically 20 different patterns on these targets. And we were shooting at 20 yards. And I will say that I do think a turkey choke is a really important piece of equipment.
Very much so.
If you can have one. Because a lot of the young people that were just shooting a regular modified choke or, you know, a choke that comes with your shotgun you know, that pattern at 20 yards is so scattered that any bird beyond that, it's really becoming iffy quick.
A turkey choke will make a hunter more effective and more efficient, which is a good thing. Is you're not going to miss or cripple birds like you would without the choke, and it's a proven fact. I mean, it works.
My daughter's shooting a 20 gauge with a turkey choke in it, and that pattern is so tight. I thought about maybe starting to hunt with that gun. You know, I really like it. It's light, getting it around the mountains and stuff down there. You know, with that turkey choke, I'd feel real comfortable telling her to shoot out to 30, 40 yards.
I've got a 20 gauge, a Mossberg. It's a youth gun, but I put a little bit of extended stock on it when I hunt with it. And I got an Indian Creek choke tube in it, and that's what I hunt with now. And I love it because it's so lightweight. I've got a sling on it. I carry my tripod, my camera. I've got this over my shoulder. Oh, it works great.
Yeah, I definitely want to encourage people to not only get a turkey choke into your gun if it'll accept one, but to really work on shooting that gun prior to the season.
They need to shoot the gun before the season.
Get to know your pattern. Work with a couple of different loads. Find out what works for you. That's where you really
need
to spend some time with gear.
We get the guns in camp and get the media guys. We go out on the side of the hill and shoot clay birds with them so they get familiar with the gun.
Yeah,
worked really well.
But just knowing your gun. If you're going to invest in something, invest in that. Invest in making sure your gun shoots well. I think that's more important than having the newfangled camouflage.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that for sure.
Well, Ray, we're running out of time here, and I really appreciate everything you've done for the Governor's Youth Turkey Hunt and helping us share this tradition with the next generation. Any last parting words of wisdom as we come? This is going to come out the day before turkey season.
We said, and you said at the youth hunt, and I tell everybody every place I go, more than anything else, have fun. Have a good time with it. Make it fun. Don't get so serious. Don't overthink, overevaluate when you go turkey hunting. Think about the tradition. Think about your hunting heritage, and think about taking somebody that has never turkey hunted and share the woods with them and get out and enjoy it. But most of all, have fun with it. Too many guys take this turkey hunting way too serious.
Well, I hope you have a great season, and thanks for everything you do.
Well, thank you.